This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I compare you to, thanks, I compare you to the mayor of Pharaoh, my beloved one. Novu lechayayich batorim, your cheeks are adorned with earrings. Tzavarech becharuzim, your neck with a necklace. Torei zohov naaseh loch, earrings of gold we shall make for you. Im nekudos hakosef, with little specks of silver. Ad shehamelech b'mesiboy nidino samrechoy, before the king is even at his party, my perfumes give off their smell. Tzro hamor dodi li, my beloved one is like a compact bundle of myrrh, which is a myrrh type of a spice. Ben shodai yolin, he rests between my breasts. Eshkol hakofer dadili, my beloved one is like a bunch of grapes. Becharmei en gedi, not even grapes, like a bunch of blossoms from the vineyards of En Gedi. That is the, those are the sentences, and they don't make a whole lot of sense. So let's understand what this dialogue is and what the snapshot of this is. So let's start first with the man-woman relationship. Don't forget, she has said that she's, if you go back to verse 5, Shechoro ani vanav, although I am black, I am beautiful. In other words, although my external side is dark and I become dirty in my deeds and so on, but my being, my essence is beautiful. Don't look at my blackness, because it's only the tan, it's only the sun, it's not my essence. My essence has not become blackened. So the woman here is complaining, or not complaining, she's conscious of a certain unattractiveness about her, and she's aware of that and worried about it, and she's brought that up and said, but look deeper. Superficially I'm not the most beautiful woman, but look a little bit deeper than that. Now his response is, firstly, Lesusosi berichvei paro, I compare you to the mare of the chariot of Pharaoh. Why that? But firstly, why compare it to a mare? And why the chariot of Pharaoh? Dimitich rayosi, I compare you, my beloved one. Well, the first thing is that horses come from Egypt, don't they? That's where horses originate from. Did you know that? That's right. The original breed of horses were bred in Egypt. So if we go back to the source of the horse, it's Egypt. And whose horse would have been the finest of horses? Pharaoh's. So he says, but I see authenticity in you. Now, what's interesting, he doesn't answer, oh, don't worry, that's not true, you really are beautiful. He acknowledges, she has said, superficially, I'm not beautiful, I know that. But look deeper than that. And he is responding, and we'll turn it back into the man-god dialogue a little bit later, but at this point, he is then responding and saying, yes, he's not saying you are beautiful, but he's saying, I see authenticity in you. You are like a thoroughbred that comes from the source, that is the original breed, and of the noble part of the original breed. The original breed comes from Pharaoh, and you are the most noble of that. So he takes the horse, which is a very noble animal. How many people here go horse riding or have gone horse riding? Okay, so you know what the nobility of a horse, you know what it feels like to sit on a horse, and what a really beautiful horse looks like, and how it moves. There's a reason for which it's been the sport of kings, and the animal, the favored animal of kings, because there is this nobility. So not only do I attract you to the most authentic, the source of all the breeds, but I see in you the most noble of that breed. And when you're looking at the horse of Pharaoh, a fairer chariot, the most choice horse from the most choice breed, you're looking at a lot more than just the superficial beauty. I see an authenticity in you. And furthermore, it's true, maybe you're not the most beautiful, but you can adorn your cheekbones with earrings. You can put on a necklace. You can do something with your beauty. You can wear jewelry. And that's going to adorn you, and that's going to make you look even more beautiful. We're going to make you these beautiful earrings with little spots of silver. That's his response to her. So his response to her is, don't worry, I see far beyond the surface, and even the surface we can do something about. Even the surface we can adorn, even the surface we can make beautiful. And you would look beautiful in that. It would be fitting for you. Her response to that is, even before the king is at his banquet, and there are different ways of taking this phrase, but the one that we'll take for the moment is, my perfumes give off their smell. So now she says, yes, but I'm not going to rely on the jewelry you're going to make me. I'm going to do something even before you come to the party. I'm going to make sure that at least my perfumes will give off their smell. Now, what is the image of the perfume? The image of the perfume is the smell, aroma, is a taste of things to come. Isn't that right? You smell before you taste. You smell before you, sometimes before you even see. So if you're invited to dinner somewhere and you walk into the house before you even see the dinner, you smell it. You get an idea of what's to come. And the smell, the aroma, is a very important mood setter. And it's one of the many things that we've extracted from our lives today. And that's such a pity. For example, with fast foods and taking food out of the deep freeze and putting it in the microwave and instant coffees, these are all ways that we take the preparation out of food. And what that does is it doesn't give the time for the senses to start becoming tuned in and alerted to what there is. What happens when you're cooking? Normally, if you go through the full process of cooking and you're preparing it, there's a beautiful smell, and the smell starts going out, goes out all over the house. I'm sure you do. I certainly do. As a child, I remember the smells of my mother's cooking even more than the taste. I remember what it was like to come home from school and to smell the food. And it stays with one. It's the most subtle of all the senses, but it's one of the senses that stays with one. How often does it happen that you'll go somewhere and you'll smell something and it will bring back a whole lot of memories? Even more so sometimes than seeing something, because the smell is so deep. In Kabbalah, the smell is considered the closest to spirituality of all the senses. That's why we use besomim on Mitzvah Shabbos, to uplift us. It's a mood setter. And we've almost extracted that from life. And she says it's part of makeup also. It's part of the way a woman is able to create an attractiveness that he senses even before she arrives. So all the things that a woman can do to make herself attractive, even if she isn't the most stunningly beautiful woman, there are things she can do. There is her character, the authenticity of her character and her personality. There's the jewelry and the clothing and the adornments, and there's the perfumes. So she can create an aura, an atmosphere, a mood of attractiveness that even precedes her, that gets there even before he turns up. And so she says, well, I'm not going to sit back and wait for the jewelry. I'm going to do whatever I can do. And one has a sense in this relationship that she is poor, or that she doesn't have resources. He's the king. He has resources. He's going to make her jewelry. And she's saying, but there are things I can do too. I can take care of the perfume so that you will want me, so that you will want to give me this. I'm going to create desire in you. I'm not going to sit there and wait for you to want me. I'm going to make you want me, even though I'm not the most beautiful and even though I don't have the jewelry. But there are mood creators that I can govern. And then she says, however, with all that perfume, you, Dodili, you are to me the Tzor HaMor. Mor is a very, very powerful smell, a spice that needs to be worked in order to release its smell. It doesn't just give off a natural smell. It needs to be worked, and with heat. And she says, and we'll analyze that too, you to me, even though I'm going to give up the perfume and so on, don't think that that's going to drown your sweet smells. You are to me the Tzor Hamor that rests between my breasts. And what is she saying? That when we do get together, your smell will overwhelm mine, but yours needs working. I understand it's not just going to come. There's a willingness on her part to do things, to engage in that relationship, to bring the smells out of him, not just to overwhelm him with her smells. Her smells are only there, her aromas and the beautiful smells of her perfume are only there to create the attractiveness, and then she will work him and get the best out of him, and then it will become like more, which will overpower her too, and she will enjoy and immerse herself in the aromas of him. Now the aroma, apart from its true natural meaning, but as we've been discussing it, is also those things that a person does, their actions that a person does, that create desire and beauty beyond their own personality. Sometimes a person is attractive by who he or she is, and sometimes they're attractive by what he or she does. And the aroma is something that goes beyond. The aroma, unlike the adornments, unlike the jewelry, which is something that is attached to her, the aroma is something that goes beyond her. And so when she's talking about these smells, what she's talking about is deeds, what she's talking about is actions. And if we understand it in that way, then she's saying, Ad Shamelchem Siba, even before the king comes to his party, Nibi Noson Reichel, he will be aware of my actions. There will be an awareness of me. My personality will be projected. He'll have a sense of me even before he sees me. But the actions of his actions are going to be even more overpowering to me. But it's interesting that it's more that is used. It's that spice that needs working. In other words, I will help him extract these actions and develop these actions until that becomes the overwhelming aroma of our relationship. It will be those actions that I'm able to get from him. So if we're looking in the action area, it comes back to what we discussed last week. Her smell is not a competing smell with his. Her smell is the one that sets the mood and gets it going, and then she works on his smell, and his smell merges with hers, and there's a whole new, very powerful smell dominated by his smell rather than by hers, is the image of this relationship. Now let's look at it in the man-God relationship. So again, God says to the Jewish people, true, you're not the most beautiful. There are other nations that have more external beauty than you have, but you are the authentic breed that comes from Egypt, that was the king's own horse. So I see in you breeding, and I see in you authenticity. That's what there is. And when we learn something like Shirashirim, what we're looking at is the beauty of the Jewish people as it's meant to be. And it's really important in doing so of getting a clear picture of what the model is. There are two parts to the study of Torah. The one is understanding the model, and the other is bridging the gap between the reality and the model. Those are the two elements of Torah. If you don't understand the model, then you're not going to bridge the gap. There either isn't a gap, or you're going to go in the wrong direction. So the first thing is to understand the model. Very often, let me take a step back. The rabbi's role is to teach the model. That's all he can do. He can say, this is the Torah, this is the way it's meant to be. Now comes a very different question. What do I do about that? I'm far from that model, so what do I do? That's the point at which the individual has to take responsibility, and where friends are important. So the piece of Pirkei Avos that we're learning at the moment on Shabbos afternoon, Aser lecha rav u'kneh lecha chaver, make for yourself a rav and acquire for yourself a friend. There are two different aspects. The rav is the one who teaches the model. The friend is the one who urges you, or the friends are those who urge one another to bridge the gap. Because very often, either an individual doesn't see that he's out of the model. You know, sometimes you hear the maru and you hear this perfection being described, and you think, well, that describes me quite perfectly, actually. Sometimes people just don't realize that they're out of the model, and you need an honest friend to say, hey, did you hear that shir? Do you know what it means? Do you know that that's not what you're doing? Do you know that you're opposite to that? Now, what are you going to do about it? That's what a friend does. Because we like to go through life with illusions, thinking that we're doing it just right. And that's why you can give a shir and give a shir and give a shir, and nothing changes. People don't change from a shir. People change from friends that urge them to bridge that gap, that point out to them. And that needs honesty, and that needs a willingness to be open. And that's why perhaps one of the biggest distortions of the Torah is when one presents the Torah as a description of who one is. It's a very enticing, very seductive thing to do. To read this and give an audience an impression, and this is you, dear people. This is being, and you walk away feeling, aren't we beautiful? Look what the Jewish people is, look what we are. And one walks away with a great feeling of upliftment, but no change. And to me, that's one of the greatest distortions of Torah, to use Torah as an affirmation of who you are. We're not in this world for that. That's for the world to come. When we come to the world to come, God will tell us who we are, and he'll either tell us what for it and give us what for, or he'll affirm us and say, you're great, you're wonderful. But the reason we're here is to change who we are. The moment we are who we're meant to be, we will die. That is one of the points at which God will take our lives, when we've made it. Or when he just gives up and says, this guy's never going to make it. And so there's no point in wasting any more time. If we give off the sense to God either that we're never going to make it, because we're not going anywhere, or we've made it after 120 years, that's when there's no point in living. Life is about bridging the gap. Life is about changing. Life is about growing. So to present the Torah to people and allow people to walk away thinking, oh, aren't the Jewish people wonderful? And isn't it great to be Jewish? Isn't it wonderful to be there? That's not what it's for. What it's for is to say, wow, what a model. What a model of perfection. And look at where we are. Look at that distance. What can I start doing to start bridging that gap? What can we start doing to start bridging that gap? But the first thing is one has to acknowledge that distance, find beauty in the model rather than in the reality, and have friends who are able to help one in that process, because we can't do it alone. We're not honest enough with ourselves to do it alone. Now sometimes a rabbi will take that double role. So a rabbi will be a rabbi and a chaver. And he'll do that urging as well. But that is not his main function. Rav means teacher. Here is the model. I'm teaching the model. And further, a rav will go further when there is a gap between the model and the reality that cannot be bridged. And where there's because of a halachic problem, he will help with that, and to try and resolve the halachic, to bridge the halachic reality. But in terms of the change of the self development of the transformation, that people need to do themselves, and they can do that only with the help of friendship. And as important as it is for a community, for instance, talking about what a community is a group of people who may be led by a rabbi, but who spur one another on and don't take nonsense from one another, who establish standards for one another, who urge one another to move and to change. And one of the most frustrating things for any rabbi as opposed to teacher of any other material is the extent to which the learning is likely in most cases to remain unchanging in the person. That a rabbi can teach and teach and teach and teach, and after 20 years the congregation is still where it was 20 years ago. And people say, so what is the flaw? Why has nothing happened? If that doesn't happen, then the next level of frustration is there is change, but the change is external. So yes, the congregation is becoming more religious, and that's very nice and that's wonderful, but there's not transformation. This isn't people becoming bigger people and finer people and better people. And that's the next most frustrating thing. And it's a puzzle as why is that happening? It's not because of lack of rabbinic leadership. You can have the greatest rabbi, he will have zero impact if an individual isn't working with his friends to take that and to transform that into something of change, and to say after every shiur, what does that mean I have to change? Because if a shiur doesn't leave you with something that you have to change, then the shiur has been wasteful. And that means changing, not just changing today, it means changing from today, something that I'm going to be doing different. And shiur ha-shiurim is an example of a book like that. It's all too easy for us to look at it and think of this beautiful shiur ha-shiurim, and the next thing we might look at is how beautifully it describes us Jewish people. It's not describing us Jewish people. It's describing what God wants us to look like. This is God's dream book. This is how He wants His beloved to look. This is His fantasy. And what we have to be able to do is to bring that fantasy into a reality and to realize that's what God wants, and He will help us do it if we understand the gap. So when God looks at us and says, don't worry about the fact that you're not so beautiful on the outside, I see in you the authenticity and the breeding of Pharaoh's horse. Just imagine any old horse looks pretty good, and then occasionally you see a horse that looks, we went horse riding off in Northern California, and some of the horses look ordinary, but even the older ones look pretty great, but some look grand. And this was just a silly old horse in Northern California. They weren't going to let us get on any of their real good horses. They were real good horses we didn't even see. And then you've got the horses that are thoroughbreds, and then you've got the thoroughbreds that come all the way, can trace their descendancy to Egypt, and then you've got the actual horses in Egypt from which they come, and then you've got Pharaoh's horse. Just imagine what that looks like. And God says, that's who you are, Jewish people. And our response is not to say, isn't that wonderful? So we're not that beautiful, but at least we're Egyptian horses. We're thoroughbreds. We're thoroughbreds. That's not what this is about. This is God saying, my fantasy is that when I look at you, I should see an Egyptian thoroughbred. Now see what you can do about that. Perhaps you can make that fantasy come true. Don't worry about the color of your skin. There's nothing you can do about that. Don't worry about the length of your nose, and don't worry about the fact that you don't have the best features and you're not that athletic. Don't worry about that. You're not going to change that. That's not what I want from you. I want the breeding. I want the authenticity. And that you can change. That you can give me, because you've got it inside you. And that's what I want to see emerging out from you. And our role then is to look at that model and to look at that fantasy of God's, and to say, what do I do to become that thoroughbred that God wants to see in me? What can I do to become that Egyptian thoroughbred? And then God goes on further and He says, and in addition to that, novel lechayach matorim, you do have features. And now there are two different kinds of features. There's Greek features. If you look at Greek beauty, and you look at some of those Greek statues, more than the Roman ones, you'll see perfection, and the kind of perfection, and that's why most of them are without clothes on, because their clothes only detract this perfection. Now, there are no human beings who are so perfect, and that's why they're unreal, and that's why they were worshipped, and there was this whole thing there. The Greeks were pretty magnificent, but not quite as perfect as that. But they create a perfection of body, and their whole religion, their whole philosophy was perfection of body. The Olympic Games and everything that went around that was perfection of body. That's one kind of beauty. There's another kind of beauty, and that is the kind of beauty where, and you'll see it sometimes with an incredible makeup person. You know these people who work in the beauty stands, and they make some people and some women look beautiful, and they make some women think that they look beautiful, but in either case, some of the real good ones, what do they do when they see a woman? They look at a woman and they say, with this she would look great. Isn't that right? Isn't that what goes through their minds? The real artists or the fashion designers, somebody who can really look at a woman and say, this item of clothing, or I can imagine what item of clothing this particular woman would look magnificent. Now that's a different kind of beauty to the Greek beauty. The Greek beauty is perfection that needs no adornment. Anything you would add to that would only detract from it. But that's not human perfection, and it's certainly not Jewish perfection. Jewish perfection is a body that can be adorned into something magnificent, that it needs additions, it needs the jewelry, and it needs the makeup, and it needs the clothes. And then you have magnificence. That's the Jewish beauty. It's a completely different beauty. Because there's chaim, there's authenticity, there's nobility. And what does all that mean when there's authenticity and nobility? How does that translate? It translates into movement, translates into the way a person, and we're not just talking about women, we're talking on two levels, the man, woman, so we're talking about women in the superficial sense, and translating that into the Jewish nation. And just as you can have a woman and you can notice her from miles away, not because of what she looks like, but because of the way she moves, the grace with which she moves, you can notice. There's a beauty in movement. There's a beauty in movement that is more lasting. There's a beauty in movement that is more enticing than the mere physical beauty, which isn't lasting, which isn't there always. But the beauty of movement, you can have a woman of 85 or 95 who has an unbelievably graceful movement, and that doesn't change. She has that. That's a mobility. That's a breathing. The way she talks, the way she, the actions, that gives a sense of beauty. That's Jewish beauty. That we have the ability to create beauty with ourselves rather than to be beauty. And the one is through that authenticity and that nobility that expresses itself in the way we interact, in the bearing that we have, in the way that we function. And I've told you so often about the magnificence of some of the true Torah personalities. Some of them were not that magnificent. They had other things that were attractive about them. But all were, you look at any of the even in some of the pictures, give you a sense of that, of the majesty of the Gedolei Yisrael. When you look at a great Talmid Chacham, there's a majesty to him. And I've given you those examples of the Kovner Rav, who used to go for his daily walk, and it was on the tourist sites of Kovner. At such and such a time, go to the main boulevard of Kovner, that's the time that you'll see the Kovner Rav going for his walk, and it's something to see. And the tourists, the non-Jewish tourists from all over, used to come to Kovner. The streets were lined when the Kovner Rav took his stroll, because people wanted to see that majesty. I've told you the stories often of when I was a child with a point of vision of how non-Jews used to stand up, how they used to come and gaze at him because of the majesty of the man's bearing, the majesty of his features, the majesty of his face, the twinkle of his eye, and the brilliance of his smile. His face is in front of me every day. There's not a day in my life that I don't see the face of the point of vision of, and he died when I was a young boy. But that impression of that majesty is there. That's something that we have. Was he an athletic looking person? No. Would he have ranked in the fashion halls of today? Of course not. But people gazed at him in ways that they don't gaze at the film stars. The admiration, the adoration with which they looked at a man like that. And that's what God wants from us. That's the kind of nobility and the kind of authenticity that he wants from us. That's not good. But he's not saying, when you look at a Jew and he looks ugly, don't worry, deep down he's a nice person. That's not what he's saying. When he talks about the image of the Egyptian horse, he's saying, you look at this, yes, it's a horse, it's not a human being, it's not the most beautiful. A horse is not beautiful. If you actually look at a horse's features, look at a horse's face. Is it beautiful? I've never seen a beautiful horse's face. I've never seen a horse's face that is beautiful. It's not beautiful, it's actually ugly. Look at the hole, and you look at the movement, and you look at the way it stands, and you look at the way it walks, and the way it runs. There's magnificence, there's power, there's beauty in that. That's Jewish beauty. And then there's the marvel of Chaya, to be able to notice in her that she would look great with a certain type of earring. And you can almost picture the earrings that King Solomon is talking about, because he says your cheeks would look great with earrings. Earrings aren't to adorn ears. Earrings are to adorn a face. Earrings are to adorn a cheek. One can imagine them hanging down, you know, like the Yemenite jewelry that hangs very low and emphasizes the elongation of the face and the neck. So it takes something that is there already, and by framing it and by creating beauty around it, elevates the beauty of the face. And he is saying to his beloved, or God is saying to us, yes, just looking at your facial features, Greeks are more attractive than you are. But when you put on the right jewelry, when you put on the right pair of earrings, two gorgeous South Sea pearls with, you know, drop diamonds attached to them, and on the most magnificent subtle gold chain, and they hang and they move in your face as you move your head around, believe me, no Greek can touch you. That's what God is saying. But you need the earrings. And your neck, you know, do you have the most magnificent neck? No, but you know, you have a certain bearing that when you put on a gorgeous diamond necklace, and you walk down the street with those South Sea pearl earrings and that diamond necklace, people are going to turn their heads. Don't worry about your beauty. That's who you are. That you can carry that off. There are some beautiful people who can't carry that off. They're too plastic. But you're not. You're authentic and you're noble, and you can carry that off, and you'll look gorgeous when you carry that off. Now, how does that come into the Jewish people again? As we are, there's nothing attractive about it. We have to dress up. We have to adorn ourselves. And what do we adorn ourselves with? Batorim. What is the word that you see there? What word is emphasized in the word Torim? What word is intonated at Torim, in the word Torim? Torah. Right, Torah in the singular or the plural? Plural. Sounds like Old and New Testament to you, doesn't it? Your face will be adorned with Torahs. What does it mean with Torahs? With the written law and the oral law. Have you imagine a ball, not a round ball, a dance ball, beautiful, just allow your imagination to get into one of these Viennese ballrooms, and imagine a princess, and you're invited to this ball, and there's music playing, and you come into the room, and you look around, and all these beautifully dressed men and women, and everybody's very, very elegant, and you're waiting for the princess to make her entry. You look up to the stairway and finally you see her coming down in this beautiful gown, wearing this magnificent necklace and one South Sea pearl earring. Well, what happens? What do you do? What do you say? What happens in the room when that happens? It looks odd and people laugh and it looks very funny. That's what it looks like when we keep one part of the Torah. It's incongruous, it's unbalanced. You need Torim, it's the earrings. Unless you've got the written law with the oral law, the law looks imbalanced. The oral law's function, the function of the Gemara and everything that goes with it, is to create balance, is to create a sense of normality, is to create the beauty. If you're just going to try and implement the written law as it is, it's going to look incongruous and unbalanced. And so it's to back to a rim, just as you need two earrings to create that sense of beauty around the face. So you need to have two Torahs. You need to have the written law. And the important thing of the written law, as we discussed in the Ten Commandments here, are those principles that just never ever change, that are never compromised. We cannot develop the written law. We cannot change the written law. We cannot modify it in any way. That's it. It's always been and it will always be and it will never change. And the oral law, which changes every day, the oral law which is developing and which is growing and which deals with the issues of the day, and it's a constantly changing process of law. And those two together create the two earrings. If there is only the inflexibility of the written law, we look ridiculous. If there's the constant changing of the oral law without the firmness of the written law, we look ridiculous. So if we are conservative Jews who are rewriting our laws all the time, it's like wearing one earring. It looks it'd be better to wear no earrings, because at least that's authentic. And if we're fundamentalists who go only with this never-changing dogmatic principle, and we don't learn how to apply and how to evolve and how to deal with modern issues in a way that is authentic and yet modern and able to function, we also lose a balance. We also lose that beauty. It's na'avu lechayach. You have two cheeks to your face, and you need two earrings, and that is the Torim. Savorech, and your neck. The charuzim, a necklace is, the beauty of a necklace is the way things connect. That's what a necklace is. And if a necklace is solid, it isn't beautiful. A necklace is only beautiful if it can move. And if it can move, it needs to be made of links. And the important part of links is not just the quality of each link, but what's important is how they connect together and the fluidity with which they move. So there again, we have the combination of links. Each link is solid. And each link is firm, and each link doesn't change, but they're connected together in a way that has motion in them, in a way that has adaptability, that can follow the shape of the neck, that can sit comfortably on the neck, implying once again this combination of flexibility with inflexibility, the combination of those things that are genuine and authentic, with those things that can fit, can be made to fit in a way that looks good. And then he says, Torah Zohov Ma'aselach, we will make golden earrings for you in the kudos hakosef, of touches of silver. Gold represents that never changing, stable, the written law, and silver is the more unstable, the less permanent oral law. And then the people of Israel respond, and they say, Ad she'hamelech b'mesibo ned ino samlecha. It's all wonderful. You're going to give us this Torah, you gave us this Torah, the two earrings and the necklace, and with that we are adorned. And that means if we live without that Torah, we're ugly. There is nothing attractive about a Jew who is living without his Torah. And if there is anything attractive, then it's usually something he has borrowed from someone else. So you might see an American secular Jew who's attractive, although he's not observant or religious in any kind of way, but that's because he's adopted the American way and he's attractive in his Americanism. But if you want to see what a Jew looks like when he's lost his Torah, then Israel is one of the best places to see that. Because when an Israeli loses his Torah, he doesn't become an American. When an Israeli loses his Torah, he doesn't become an Englishman, or a South African, or a Frenchman. When an Israeli loses his Torah, he becomes a Bedouin. He's from the Middle East. There is no, that is, Judaism is the religion of the Middle East, or Islam. So he doesn't become a Muslim when he loses his Torah. There is a coarseness that exceeds the coarseness that one would find in other parts of the world. And if we're living without our jewelry, then there is an ugliness. God has not said you're not ugly. He said you're right, you are ugly on the surface. There are more beautiful people than you. But if you dress right and you use your jewelry right, you will look more majestic than anybody. But don't go out without your jewelry, because you will look ugly. And again, that's the man, woman, and that's the Jew and the nations. And we should discuss briefly why it is so. The fact is that just as every woman can improve her appearance and does do so by what she wears and how she presents herself, and if she doesn't pay attention to that, she looks incredibly unattractive. Even attractive women can sometimes look unattractive if that isn't taken care of. So with the Jewish people, we look terribly unattractive if we don't take care of the beauty and congruence and nobility of our actions in terms of the Torah. We can look incredibly ugly. Why is it that there is that? Why is it that it's not enough to be naturally beautiful, that God's desire is not to be naturally beautiful? God's desire is that we should have the material and the talent to create beauty out of who we are, rather than to be beautiful. Why is that? Why would you think that's so key to being a woman? And so key, if women are so beautiful, why do they need makeup and fashion? Men should use it. If women are more beautiful than men, and they are, then they should not need makeup and fashion. Makeup and fashion surely would indicate the opposite. The answer is no. It's not a contradiction in terms. There is the beauty of women is the beauty of knowing how to use adornment in an incredible way. The beauty of the Jew is to know how to use adornment in an incredible way. And when either does not use that in adornment, they're more unattractive than the other species. A woman who is not well got together looks worse than a man who's not well got together. A man can look quite attractive if he's wild, but a woman doesn't usually. A non-Jew can look quite attractive if he doesn't have any Torah. In fact, he looks more attractive if he doesn't have any Torah. A Jew looks very unattractive if he doesn't have any Torah. Why did God create us that way? Because that's godly beauty. Godly beauty is beauty we create with him, not beauty he's created. The godly beauty in the human being is when we create a partnership. When we look beautiful because we're taking what he gave us and we're adding to that what we can and how we can improve that and develop that. That's the kind of beauty that he admires, both in the women and in the Jewish people. But she says, I'm not going to wait for the jewelry, and I'm not going to wait for you to do it to me. Ad she'hamelech b'nesibo, even before you come to the party, which here means before Sinai, I started at least giving up a smell. At least you could smell that there was something nice there, because I started behaving in a nice way. I didn't have the mitzvahs yet, but I still had the herits. I still knew how to behave in a fine way, how to be kind, how to be good. There were a few little mitzvahs that I did have before Sinai, and I started keeping those mitzvahs already, so that I created some sense of beauty to start off with. I initiated it with actions of my own. It wasn't initiated at Sinai. I initiated it before Sinai with my actions. But then your response has been, Tzor Hamor, your concentrated sanctity you brought down into our temple. And it wasn't just that you left me to be beautiful. You came into that beauty you created part of that aroma and part of that that fragrance, that beauty, that beautiful smell that I just started off very subtly before Sinai. You then brought your concentrated fragrance right into our midst, between my breasts, which is the image for between the two poles of the Orem. The Orem, you remember, was the box in which the Ten Commandments were kept, and there were two poles by which they used to carry it when they used to move. But even when it was rested, those two poles were there. So if you can picture it, the Orem with the box and the two poles sticking out beyond that, and then there was a cloth thrown over that, and that was the image of the breast, if you can try and picture what that looked like. And God's presence was between those poles. That's where the Shekhinah used to be, creating that image of incredible intimacy and affection. And the Jewish people saying, yes, I've done my bit with our deeds. We've tried to make ourselves attractive so as to bring you in. Not as attractive for you to stand off and admire us, but to an attraction that enabled you to bring your sanctity and to place that sanctity between my breasts, or between the two poles of the Orem, right in the most intimate part of the Jewish people, in the very center of the Jewish presence and conscience in the temple. And it's a kind of fragrance that has to be worked. It doesn't just sit there and make a beautiful smell. It needs fire. It needs passion. It needs us to be involved with you. It needs us to be engaged with you. It needs us to be doing the mitzvahs, to be studying the Torah. If we can engage with you with the passion, with the fire of passion, you will release some of that fragrance, which will far overwhelm our little fragrance that we've tried, and we will then have the fragrance of God. We start off with our own little fragrance, but the relationship means that at the end of it, the fragrance that we have as a nation is the fragrance of God. And then lastly, still on the fragrance, Eshkol HaKofer Dodili. You are like a bunch of kofer. I don't know what the English translation of kofer is, but it's a beautiful smelling blossom that you find in the vineyards. But what's important is the Hebrew word kofer. What word do you see in that word? What word can you notice in the root of Eshkol HaKofer in verse 14? Can you see a word there? Kafir. What does that mean? Atonement. So part of the relationship now. So what do we thought? Let's just run through the relationship. We started to go. We said, "Ooh, how can we get into a relationship? We're not very attractive." Although deep down we know we have qualities, on the surface we're not really attractive. How can we compete with the other nations of the world? God responds and says, don't worry, I see nobility and authenticity in you. I see the Egyptian horse in you. I see breeding in you. Don't worry about that. So provided you can develop that breeding and live with that breeding, that's much more important, because if you have a person with breeding and you add some beautiful earrings and a gorgeous necklace, and you can look magnificent. And then the Jewish people say, well, I won't even wait for that. I'll start with the fragrance. And now the Jewish people, with their authenticity and a little bit of fragrance, God getting all excited and thinking this looks beautiful, creating necklaces and earrings for the Jewish people, adorning them with those necklaces and earrings. And then the Jewish people saying, but now, you know, I don't want to just look like the beautiful one. I want your beauty in my midst. I want to draw you into my midst, and I want to absorb your beauty and enjoy your beauty and the fragrance of your spice. Now what's the next critical thing for the relationship? So now you've got the intimacy. They're together. What is the name? It doesn't stop there. There has to be the capacity for atonement. Atonement. If there isn't the capacity for atonement in a relationship, the relationship can't function, because they're going to be tough times. They're going to be times when they're going to disappoint one another. So what the couple needs to do even before they come together is to create the rules for atonement. What are we going to do when we hurt one another? What are the rules going to be? Not just the rules of getting together, the rules of staying together. And the most important rule of staying together is the Eshkol HaKofer. There is a spice of atonement as well, and we have to create the capacity to atone, because we are going to do wrong. And we've got to build the rules for atonement in life in the beginning. And God, when you came into our midst, you came with sacrifices. And sacrifices, and that's the implication here, are our instrument of achieving atonement. You didn't just come, you came and taught us how to keep that relationship intimate using the process of atonement. The Chalmei Ein Gedi, like these blossoms that are in the orchards of, in the vineyards of Ein Gedi. Ein Gedi is a very beautiful, of course we know where Ein Gedi is today, but what's important about Ein Gedi is there's a wonderful spring there, so it's an oasis. Spring of very pure and sweet water. The Ayin means that. Ayin is the spring of Gedi. And the implication here is that provided we drink from that spring, remember the Jewish people asking a few weeks ago, how are we ever going to get it right? If our beauty we're talking about here, there are times we're going to get it wrong. What chance do we have if our relationship is dependent on the way we behave? Over the years, we're going to do things wrong. He says, God, there are two things. There's the Eshkol HaKofer, there's the capacity for atonement as long as you're drinking water from Ein Gedi. As long as you're drinking healthy water, as long as you're drawing on a healthy resource, as long as you're learning Torah, as long as you're going back to the source, as long as there's purity and authenticity, water is Torah. As long as your Torah is pure, not any old water, Ein Gedi, the purest, most beautiful, most sweet-tasting water. If you're drinking that water, if that's what you're drawing from, and you've got the capacity for atonement, you've got the system of sacrifice, then we can keep that relationship together. And that's what the Jewish people then are praising God for, not only for coming into our midst, but for teaching us how to keep Him in our midst.
Now it's so close to the spiritual. It's interesting that other religions use incense during their prayer, and we just use a little bit of the don't use it much for prayer.
Because we don't want to be intoxicated by fragrance in prayer. Prayer is a time that we want to create whatever we're doing from within ourselves. So while we don't want an external stimulant in prayer, and that's why our buildings of prayer are not these like cathedrals and things like that. The non-Jewish religions rely heavily on the external to create a mood for prayer. And we say no, need for prayer has to come from within the individual, and it comes from everybody davening, and that's why we daven aloud, and there's interaction, it's social. The need for prayer is created by people in a minyan, not by a building or by a fragrance or by a picture on the wall. Good, thank you, ladies.
And then yesterday she said, I'm so bad with you too. I'm seeing everything going on. So it's good. The first day's been good.
Wonderful. Thank you, Sarah.
So thank you. Two plates of Olivia. They just have to sell them to Olivia.
Thank you.
What if the four of you came to say for Shabbos? Go sleep in the family room. Also, when we had company in, we did sports. But, so we really have to have you and your children come and stay with us. Email me.
Thank you for your invitation.
Oh, but you want that question saying that. I share the personal feeling that you don't have aspect with the first report.
If that's getting out to her.
I don't know.
You said the first report
has the first. I'm going to take them all. I think it's there to be a new one.
Do you have a few minutes?
Sure. No.